Phil Neame, Reel 5.
And I think it was this period of time between half an hour or so between my last having engaged the enemy with our machine guns and Sean coming up, maybe an hour, that the sort of Argentinian army had effectively collapsed, and that I think, you know, I don't know what was going on elsewhere in terms of negotiations, but that they had taken the decision to surrender. Because, as I say, suddenly no longer were we getting, you know, answering fire back. Anyway, we eventually got the guns up and we got fire missions down, and then Chawla got some scouts up and they went in and started to engage the enemy guns in the Stanley Valley. But it was by then absolutely clear that we were fighting an army which was no longer resisting, that it had totally and utterly collapsed. Quite interesting, as I say, it almost sort of happened, almost a tip, you know, in the space of half an hour, and it almost, you know, crystallised around this period of time. And I had previously opened up and been shot back at. Sean telling me to open up, this time nothing. Effectively, I think Brigade Headquarters also couldn't grasp the scale and the suddenness with which this collapse had happened, until eventually David Sean managed to persuade Julian Thompson to come up and join them and see for himself that, you know, here was a collapse and that we should therefore be allowed to exploit straight into Stanley. That things then, you know, really began to move at a pace. That's indeed what happened. A company led off down into Stanley, B company, and then me bringing up the rear. And with a distinct feeling, the war is over. To the extent that, you know, for a brief moment before we vacated Wireless Ridge, it was almost like Index, you know, the sort of, you know, well, people carrying stacks of ammunition, smoke grenades and everything else. God, but do we really need to carry this anymore? You know, lobbing off smoke grenades they didn't need anymore and so on. It was all a sort of mild celebration. And my company sergeant major, I think really rightly, I thought this is a bit perverse at the time, but I think was absolutely quite right, saw the mood that everyone was in and such that, you know, if someone didn't grip this, there was going to be an accident. And duly, sort of virtually said, Index, make safe. And sort of, you know, get live rounds out of the chamber and magazines only. And I thought at the time, you know, what's he playing at? You know, the war's not over yet. But it was probably quite a sensible thing to have done. I think, as I say, the mood that people were in, the sort of great fervour that has sort of suddenly gripped the whole company, the sort of people pulled off the helmets, put on their red berets and everything else. It was party atmosphere, and as I say, too easy for someone to have been stupidly shot at that stage. We duly marched into Stanley, occupied one of the deserted houses, and proceeded to make ourselves comfortable for the following week. End of war.
What do you think about all this business that we hear nowadays about the need for counselling?
I think it's all nonsense. I had in the company one person who went a bit funny, a bloke called Cheval, who was badly injured at the White Flag incident at Goose Green. It was Kazimak. 7 months later, rejoined the battalion, having apparently made a complete recovery, but, you know, was a complete liability as a soldier thereafter. And played the line, you know, that he was suffering, you know, the whole stress thing had been too much for him and so on. The word went round the company, which eventually percolated back to me, was, you know, don't worry about him. There's nothing wrong with him. He's only trying to play this for the South Atlantic Fund. Now, I don't know whether, you know, I mean, I'd be wrong to sit in judgment of Cheval or Wally, or, you know, but I mean, you know, the word was he'd been put up to this by his parents to get money out of the fund. Eventually he was discharged. I mean, there's no question of keeping him. I don't even know whether he got money out of the fund or not. But that was the only case, and that was questionable whether really it was a genuine case or not. I'm sure that we've all subsequently sort of, you know, dreamt through it and laid awake at night, but thought, you know, I mean, the whole experience is still very fresh in my mind. But I don't think it in any way it sort of unhinged me. I think one reason is that we had, as a company, we had a successful war. I mean, yes, we had a fair proportion of casualties, more than most perhaps. But for all that, we'd had a successful war as a company, we'd achieved everything that had been asked of us and probably more, and I think everyone in the whole company, from me down to the newest private, felt that. Now that, I think, goes a long way to overcoming any sort of, you know, subsequent traumatic stress. Whereas, I think if you were to ask the same question of someone in the Welsh Guards, you might get a very different answer. They had not had a successful war, and I think, you know, therefore the impact of something like the Galahad could well linger on and cause grief. So I think, you know, I think in a way, I suppose, you know, to be fair, you've got to sort of judge each of these things on its merits. In the battalion as a whole, I would say I could put my hand on three people who I felt had not totally come to terms with it. And this is now extremely sensitive, I think, if I mention the names. But, you know, in a way, I can't avoid identifying them. One was the battalion 2IC, one was the Padre, and one was the doctor. All three of those, I thought, they didn't fall apart, I'm not saying anything like that, but they all, I felt, looking back at them afterwards and so on, felt that they showed signs of not having really sort of totally come to terms with it and sort of said, right, it's happened, fine, in the past, get on with life. Get on with the next thing. But it's still very much there in their present and now. Now, I don't know if that still is the case, but certainly for sort of, you know, several years afterwards, I thought that was true. And I thought, well, what do they have in common? And in a way, they all have one thing in common, that they were all one step away from the sort of immediate blood and mud and gore and everything else. They weren't, you know, in there with the real sort of action. They were the planner, you know, the treater, the counsellor, you know, and they were one step away in sort of simplistic terms. Of course they were there. They were being shelled and shot at along with everyone else, but they didn't have that sort of active bit of physically getting stuck into the enemy in the same way as we did. And I wonder whether that had, there was something in common in that factor and the fact that they all, to my mind, showed a sort of slightly similar kind of attitude afterwards. Now, whether that sort of behaviour, again, is something which you call post-traumatic stress, which needs counselling, is debatable. But I always felt that those three people, they were the only, you know, the whole battalion, those three people, the only people I could sort of say behaved not oddly, but slightly differently afterwards.